Welcome to today's Core Life Chat Show. 人生知识正要开始。我是 Anita. This is another episode for my English-speaking friends. Today, we have Owen, who relocated from London to Singapore and sits next to me, sharing his experience of relocation, observations of cultural difference at the workplace, as well as core life crisis and taking risks. I quite enjoyed this episode. We had a lot of fun and sounded smart.Rarely, but we did. And I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Let's go.
We have a guest today. It's Owen. He's my colleague who sits next to me.
Hello, everyone. My name is Owen. I'm 27 years old and I'm from London in the UK. And I'm currently sitting here in Singapore, where a place that I moved to last year. So I've been working in Singapore for just over 1 year.
Yeah, to loosen things up. Oh, well, 1 to 5, how would you rate me as a colleague?
Assuming that 5 is the highest and 1 would be the lowest, mm-hmm. I would obviously rate you as a 5.
Yeah. Why?
So for those, obviously no one on listening to this will know, but when I moved to Singapore, I had already her purely on the basis that I was told she was the person I'll be sitting next to in the office. So it was worthwhile just, you know, reaching out to say hello and... If nothing else, purely on the basis of being friendly, approachable, and very much welcoming me into Singapore, which indeed many other people did, but you included. And for those values alone, I could have given you a 5, I suppose. But I think whilst it may be beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today, people don't get to see how much, and we may talk about the working culture in Asia, but we may also be worth calling out how Anita is very much in the right ways pushing to improve that working culture. And that's also something as well, I think, that means...
That is very motivational, you know.
Yeah. And that's not just to me, actually. That's almost like a rating on how valuable are you to where we work. Probably in any other company, you'd be quite valuable because of some of the things you're trying to do.
Wow. We've heard a lot of things about that. She's promoting a lot of different agenda.
Well, I think it's also just being in making the place that you work and the environment you work being interested in trying to influence it in a positive way. For understandable reasons, it's very easy to treat your job as just a place where you go
to make
9 to 5, put in what you need to, perhaps not much more, and then focus on just life outside of work. Perfectly admirable position and understandable. However, I think there are people as well that acknowledge, whether we like it or not, we spend a lot of time at work and or thinking about work. And again, whether we like this or not, it does define quite a lot of who we are, sometimes in a bit of a sad way. And so I think taking an interest in trying to change that is, first of all, interesting and sets mm-hmm. people apart. And then particularly in the ways you're trying to change it, they stand out a lot more than where I was in London. And so that, as I say, yes, is admirable, but more than admirable, I think it's good work.
She's going to cry now.
I'm just so shocked. This is a complete digress of what I have in mind.
Oh, well, you asked me to rate you, so there
yeah,
you go.
Wow, that's how a VP does things. Yeah, thank you. I was expecting this question about how I verbally attack you a lot in office.
I think there's an element that, again, we may be going to talk about it later, about the differences, and these are differences that may be actually quite obvious. But I feel that when I was working in London, people would talk to each other in the morning a lot more. And I genuinely think they actually wanted to. It wasn't the whole, oh, how are you? And then we don't really care what the answer is. People did talk to each other a bit more. Whereas we work in what can only be described at times as a library, where everyone's just silent, aside from the fact that when they're on a meeting or a call. For me, it'd be more awkward to walk into the office, sit down next to loads of people and not say good morning. Yet that is indeed what most people do. I guess maybe that is just a difference, but you've always got to be aware of the culture and the setting around you, sure. But even when I'm aware of it, I think there's nothing wrong with saying hello to people and indeed hoping that they will acknowledge, which Anita perhaps sometimes does not. But that's okay. There's no malice in that. And in fact, in fairness to her, she does acknowledge it. I need more.
Yeah.
I need more energy in return. Working on that.
Next question is, why do you choose Asia and Singapore specifically to relocate to?
So if we start with just Asia, whilst I'd studied outside of London, I had immediately upon graduating was fortunate enough to get a job. And so I started straight away, and that was in London. As most graduates do, I spent a few years living at home initially with, in my case, my grandmother. and then moved into living with some uni friends, and then eventually on my own in London. All very wonderful. However, when you are working where you've in a city you've also were born in and grew up in, there's an element of you don't want to get too comfortable, maybe you need to shake things up. Perhaps answering a slightly different question to begin with in terms of why move abroad, it's just because why not in the end, in the sense that you don't, you know, in your early 20s, it feels right to shake things up a little bit. And I was maybe quite lucky having started work straight away that almost by the age of 25, I was almost getting comfortable. And that's sometimes a word we associate, at least at some points in our life, we associate the word comfort maybe with negative things, actually. You don't want to get too comfortable. So that's why. And then very simply, you're mostly guided by where the jobs are. When you're a silly English person like me and you speak 10 only languages, English, as long as they're all English, you're not really going to move to Europe. You've got little to add for mainland Europe. So you're left with North America and Asia. And North America just didn't appeal to me. I've been to New York, as I know some of our other podcast attendees here, and just didn't do it for me.
Is it very UK?
Well, I'll
tell you, totally understand.
I mean, the thing is I really do think it's an interesting example of a mixture of what you're used to, and indeed when you're not used to something, you see it in a different light. And what? So let me give you an example. London is also a bit grimy, a bit dirty, not safe in some contexts. So is New York. So in that respect, you might say no difference. But London, I see all the nice bits. When I say I see, I mean in the most general sense, be it where do I go, the things that I notice, the things that I think, wow, that's really nice. Whereas when I went to New York, I just seemed to be fixated on all the things that weren't great, which, as I say, are not unique perhaps to New York. I just noticed them more, be it the slight dirt, the smell, the fact that there was loads of police officers, but they all looked not so athletically fit, and they're all armed with guns. And so I felt like, again, that's a big thing that always Europeans notice about the US is the firearm culture, perhaps. And it's a sensitive issue in America, but it didn't exactly make me feel safe. And, you know, in our company, for example, the first team, this was part of our training, the first thing they did was give you security training. And by that, he started by saying, I love working for my company. When I leave at the end of the day, I take off my office badge so people don't know where I work. And I was like, whoa. That thankfully, no one had to give me that talk in London. But the guy actually said, we work for a company that's got three words in the name. And one of those words is bank. And one of them is America. So, like, we are at risk in certain contexts. Anyway, New York just didn't quite do it for me. Perhaps if I had lived there, obviously I was only visiting. Another thing, I don't get the tipping culture. We don't have that. I just can't get my head around. But there we are. There's plenty of places in America I do want to go. But I would love to go to some of the depths of America, like Montana, some of the states in the middle, you know, in general. These are amazing places. But
look
just
at our faces now.
Yeah, I mean, Montana, to me, I would love to go to Montana. If anyone's wondering where that came from, there's a good movie of Leonardo DiCaprio called The Revenant, I believe it's called. And that was actually filmed in Montana. And it's quite an intense movie, but it makes Montana look interesting. So America was, at least for now, removed from the list. So then we looked towards Asia, a place that I'd actually already been before. I'd done the exchange program in South Korea. And so Asia very much so, yes. And then you've got these kind of expat hubs where there totally are jobs, so that the paths make sense. Hong Kong, Singapore, almost permanently on the radar. And then the pandemic, at least in 2022, Singapore had the edge, so to speak, in that it was very much open for business. Hong Kong was about to be open for business, but just the very fact it was a few steps behind. Yeah. So that's how I ended up here. No real desire, strong burning desire in my life to ever live in Singapore. Sounded like a nice exotic thing to. That was it. It wasn't a burning desire, but here we are, and I have to say it is wonderful. Final thing from me, and we may talk about this later about the quarter life crisis. I very much rejected this job initially. We had the contract, and I remember telling my manager in London, I'm not going to take it. And he was very happy because, I mean, he didn't have to go and hire someone new. Yeah. And I remember I used to cycle to my office, and I was cycling home one day, and I remember realizing, I've just made the wrong decision. So I called my manager the next day and said, I'm going to go.
Script that.
Yeah. It kind of like, it's the classic case of cold feet. You initially prefer the status quo. You give yourselves plenty of, you know, valid reasons why you think you shouldn't go, whilst simultaneously just ignoring all the obvious signs to why it's a good thing. And so, yes, I actually wasn't going to even move here initially, but I'm very glad I got over that and indeed did move.
Overall, it's a desire to change more than a desire to move to Singapore, right?
Yeah, I'm still a creature of habit. And so I'm not going to pretend that I was knowing that, oh, yes, always throw yourself out there, do new things. But yes, that was kind of the driver. It took me about 10 steps to get there. That is the ultimate overarching theme here, yes, because there's not much more of a plan to it than that. And I think one of the things that sealed the deal for me, I believed it after I got here, and that is that you can always return. You're not sealing the door on something permanently. You know, it's interesting. Someone at the bank told me, I used to refer to things like when I was just joining the bank and you do a few different jobs to begin with and then you decide where you want to work permanently. And I said, I'm going to go back. I said that phrase to someone. I said, I'm going to go back to this old team. And the lady at the time, she said, wrong choice of words. You're returning. and she just said the principle of like going back sounds like you're just going back to what you had before. Well, that is perhaps never an option. You are returning to the same place and it will be different. So I'll never, it does actually make me quite sad to think I'll never be able to go back to what I had in London. I wasn't in any great burning desire to leave. I had a really nice flat that now because of rent prices, I'll never have again in London. I had a really nice life. I could cycle everywhere. I could cycle to see my grandmother. I could do all the things I liked. I was in no great desire to leave. Probably that was all the things I was telling myself when I initially decided not to have a job. I can return and get most of that again. Never quite the same. And so that does upset me, but doesn't make me regret my decision at all.
I wanted to add on that you shared this aspiration when you joined the bank, right? Like you would want to explore a relocation one day in your career. And once you know that you're getting your promotion, you send out an email to all the heads and I'm, hi, I'm ready. If there's any position, please let me know.
And again, that makes it sound like there was some master plan. And people think that like, they use the word networking, and I still don't really know what networking is. These are just people I'd spoken to, either because I'd visited the country. It was a cheeky way for me to extend my holidays, was to go into our office during the day. So for the 5 years or so I was living in London, when I visited, say, Korea again to see my friends, like me, my friends all had jobs. So you may as well go into the office as well. Double benefit. You don't have to use as much holiday. And yes, you're doing work, but it's weird and novel. You can't even figure out how to get into the building. So that like takes up some time. And then everyone's like wondering who the hell you are. And especially because of our company, Hong Kong and Singapore office is very regional, get lots of visitors. Our Seoul office, for example, doesn't get so many visitors because it's a very local office. And so everyone's really friendly. They usually take you out for lunch. And so it's just all positives. And yes, as part of almost all those visits, I would say, yeah, I'd love to maybe consider working here. There's nothing, literally the sentence was no more complicated than that. It wasn't, I want to, and this is when I'm going to do it, and can I have a job? It only turned into that, as Anita said, at the beginning of 2022, partly spurred on by the fact that, yes, I just managed to obtain a promotion. Now I realize all these conversations did perhaps help, but it wasn't like there was some big master plan. It was almost like it would be rude not to. It was all part of a friendly conversation with someone you've only just met. Like, oh, wouldn't it be nice? Yes. Oh, yes. Nice to meet you and maybe see you again, you know, in a few years. And you know, it's all just part of normal conversation. So I'm glad that people remembered me in the office, but I like to think they remember me just for being normal and friendly. I mean, I like talking quite a lot, as Anita knows. For me, that's very easy. And so I was just being relaxed and that led to it.
Whatever that he said, for me, I can think of a Chinese idiom sort of like that. So, 细水长流. One day when the opportunity comes, then you'll get it. And then people might think of you in a way.
Yeah, it's just so natural. Like he doesn't have that try very hard.
But the secret ingredient, because I was able to add time. If I had been sitting there in 2017 saying by 2020 or by 2019, I have to move, otherwise I've failed. Now I'm setting myself these really like stretch goals. It would have been a completely different experience because I would have had to have come across as much more, I need something from you right now. Changes the dynamic. I really only switched on the I need something from you after 5 years or so of just getting on with my own work in London. And so that helped people say, yeah, he'll do well. We've got evidence for that, not just talk. So yes, I like that saying. That sounds like what I'm getting at exactly.
Yeah, that's something I've find in Owen that he's just very secure. I don't really feel like you have that urge to prove yourself or insufficient in some way, which is very familiar theme that I see in my peers. It's throughout. You'll see that again and again.
Not perfected by any means, but I would say that one of the things I've learned and continue to learn when I joined, and just in general, I find with people in the meeting life, in my company, there was a guy, he'd been at Bank of America when I joined 44 years, and I think by the time he retired, he'd been there for 46 years. What I learned from him, after 46 years, he did not have just linear, I've got 46 years worth of knowledge, which compared to someone that's got maybe 1 year, what was not the situation was he was 46 times more knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. And on a practical basis, as Mike would point out, when he started working, there were no computers in the bank. So all the stuff he may have had 46 years worth of knowledge on doesn't exist anymore. So he can't have 46 years of knowledge of anything because nothing he does or did stayed around that long.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did have was 46 years worth of experience in the form of being calm, not being easily flustered, mm-hmm. not feeling the need, to your point, to try and demonstrate that I'm got the most knowledge in the room, because he didn't, and he would be the first to admit it, but also the first to ask interesting questions. I could never ask his question as good as he could. I tried, and his questions were always more interesting and more useful to know the answer to the mind rubbish. And I would say that's the one thing I've tried to emulate, a mixture of not trying to take yourself too seriously, not trying, like, you haven't got to prove anything to anyone. And actually, when the dust settles, there's always people that are louder, more brazen, feel like they need to show more. But I think if you were assembling a team, if a normal person was assembling a team, they would want the calm and collected person that is almost like a trusted advisor. They'll just point out when they think, I don't agree with that, and this is why. And you can trust them to speak up. That's worth its weight in gold. And that's why he had worked there for so long, without necessarily saying, I just know everything. That's not what he brought. Because I don't know the answers, obviously, to most things, especially now that I've moved roles. That's all I've got, is questions.
It's very deep.
Yeah, that's starting a conversation with him, like.
I enjoyed it.
Because you just need to do one episode.
When did you get this kind of realization? You know, it's like, did it just one day occur to you that, oh, maybe I should think this way? Or is it because that you started working very early on compared with your peers?
No, I think I got the realization after about a year or year and a half of work. And so, like, let's stay on a purely practical basis. I remember sitting at my desk sometimes and seeing people on meetings talking about loads of things, thinking, oh my God, these are all experts. And I don't know. I don't even know how to get invited to that meeting, or do I need to set up a meeting? I was really getting focused on the practical minutiae, and I just found organically, after like a year and a half, all the work routines and that, what you needed to work on, became quite obvious. Because we work in a particular role, Anita and I, in product management, a bit of a loosely defined, but at least the way it takes form in our company, you are the ultimate owner of a product or service. There are many people that we have indirectly outsourced different functions to deliver our product, and you are responsible for its end-to-end delivery. How did I adopt this mentality? It's because, take for example, I used to work on payment services. We had people in operations that inherently were much more knowledgeable on the lower level detail of how a payment system worked, you know, how a payment file was made, and indeed how you fix it if it doesn't work, and that sort of stuff. We had people in technology who could build the software that we use to connect. We had people in legal and compliance that understood the rules better than me. We had people in sales that knew how to position it with clients better than me, and could give me market insight. It's a classic phrase. You're a jack of all trades, specialist, an expert in none. My job was to bring all these people together as and when required, and for as and when topics required. And so when you acknowledge that you being good at your job does not mean you have to know more than all these other people, you know, humbly accept that all these other people in their own areas will know more than you. Your job is to bring it all together. Then you and I adopted that mentality. But then this is where it comes a bit different in Singapore, because leaders, more often here, as a meritocracy, they've interpreted that as to say it's just more knowledge.
Yeah.
That's what I think they feel the need to be. If we have something wrong with my product, when it was in London, I would be invited to help as the person responsible for that product to come and give an opinion, you know. And if the opinion was going to have to be sufficiently, say, technical, it would be on me to not just turn up myself, but turn up with my technology contact. They would look to me. Leadership would look to me. Whereas in Asia, initially at least, my experience has been more that because I'm your manager, I'm only your manager because I know more than you. That I'm in this seat because I just know more than you. Like if we were to do a test and I would get a higher score than you, That's how people interpret it. Whereas that's not what I think it was meant to be. In fact, it's meant to be the other way around. You're the experts. I'm your manager. I'm your just managing a team, really. Yeah. So I'm doing all that, the routines that come with managing a team. So I found that people do learn from each other, yes, but there's a maybe the way people interpret meritocracy and their role.
I think that's maybe an Asian thing that, how to say that?
Seniority.
Seniority. Is that correct? Yes. Seniority is important in Asian culture, not only in Chinese, but also like Korean, Japanese.
Yep.
And like you need to change the grammar if you are addressing the same message to a senior person, and that cascade to work level as well. We also have saying that I've eaten more salt than the rice you have eaten, so you need to respect me only because of age, and maybe that shows in work culture.
And it doesn't work very well in our company, to be honest, because I'm in a role where technically now in Singapore people need to ask me or my team permission to do something. That works, and there's a reason for that, and I'm fully behind why we hold the keys, so to speak, because we're held accountable for the performance of a product. So when people are asking to do something that will change that performance, makes sense that we should say yes or no. But that's the point. We can say yes or no. Many a times approached by people who are more senior than me, they've led a deal, they want permission to make a decision that I have to say yes or no to. You then add in this dynamic here where you've not only got the seniority, you've got perhaps the age, the experience point that I was just saying. Now, all of a sudden, why are they even asking me for my yes or no? Because if I say no, they don't, because of their being more senior than me, can just overrule that and just say, well, I don't like your answer. And I'm going to take it to your boss or your boss's boss to get a different answer. This shouldn't be confused with me saying that in Europe or London, this dynamic doesn't exist. Absolutely, it does. I just think it's a bit more intense here in the sense that I do just have people that are industry, let's say, not necessarily our company, for their whole careers, perhaps do, but they definitely believe they know more than me. And again, but they're not really willing to hear me push back because it just doesn't sit right in the flow for a 27-year-old that's just arrived, much junior than them, to be basically overruling their opinion. It's not allowed. That's an outcome that cannot be accepted. That's an interesting example because in the American system, maybe it would be okay.
You know, maybe it's not that personal. Like if it's anyone not personal, but like doing their job, even with more experience, it's just their habit or nature to push back anything that's not the answer that they want. And maybe it's more often seen in Asia because getting business here is just much more difficult given our position here. Asian clients are just more pricing sensitive because things are so cheap here. And if you try to apply a global pricing structure,
however,
it's just,
But you see, this is, I even trying to acknowledge and understand that, I still sometimes have differences of opinion. And this is another thing I learned from Mike, who, in fact, with many conversations with people, I'm realizing it had quite a big impact on my life, which I didn't really realize at the time. But one of the things I learned from him was the willingness to speak truth to power. And again, going back to that point, if you're assembling a team, who do you want to be in your team? And in truth, if you're being honest with yourself, you want people that are going to speak truth to power. Because if they're not, if they're just going to be like yes people, you don't really need them. Unless you just want to have that gratification of being agreed with all the time. And so absolutely, you don't need to obstruct and speak truth to power for the sake of it or the thrill of it. But but genuinely, as a company, you know, whenever there's a plane accident, they do incredible levels of investigation to find out exactly what went wrong. And there's all TV shows about it, right? And one of the TV shows I've watched almost all the episodes of, and one of the common themes when things go wrong in an airplane and it can crash is when there's just a communications breakdown and people don't speak truth to power. There have been plenty of plane crashes, and I'm sorry, some of them more often with Asian airlines. So Korean Air had a phase in its history which it just kept on crashing. They would know through the cockpit voice recorder, through the flight data recorder, say the captain was a bit confused, which is totally normal, totally fine. Not a dangerous situation. But there's a pilot next to him who's meant to challenge and keep, you know, be that counterbalance. And there's been plenty of examples of where a captain has perhaps just been flying their plane into the ground because they're a bit disorientated, and the first officer just sat there and didn't say anything.
Mm.
When obviously, if you're flying the plane to the ground, pull it out. Yeah. Mm. And I know this is perhaps an extreme example, and it's maybe generalizing. But even Korean Air acknowledged it in that the social norms outside of the world of aviation in their culture were maybe getting in the way of safety. Yeah, they were saying that the first officers, because first officers is a junior position, so they're, mm-hmm. they're younger. And then obviously you got the actual title, so they're more junior from a title perspective. And so the idea of saying to your captain, you're actually, not only are you making a mistake, your mistake is so big, I'm going to maybe take control of the aircraft away from you. Because you're a bit disorientated, you're flying into the ground. It's the nuclear option. Mm-hmm. That's going to cause offense in given the societal norms. So some people have concluded to not even do it and just let them make the mistake. And that's quite extreme.
Enlightening example of how this culture impact our work.
And it's by no means a unique thing to Asia. I think perhaps being new here, I've just noticed it more. Because this was probably happening in the UK, but being from the UK, I was probably inherently noticing it much less because I'd just grown up.
You're used to it.
Yeah, so right. I hope this isn't concluded as me thinking, oh, it's just better in one region and not in the other. That's not perhaps the point. It's more just maybe the norms are quite different here. And being not from here,
well
I've noticed
received,
it.
Well received, no problem.
Mm. We like a good disclaimer.
When Owen says he's into aviation, he has a lot of models, like airplane models in the office. During COVID, he plays like aviation simulation program that you can just fly from Singapore to Korea for 7 hours.
Yeah. In fact, a high pressure situation was when I had a housewarming here in Singapore. I invited the team round for a dinner and I showed them like a tour of my house, and then they noticed all the setup I had for my flight simulator. My manager said, yeah, go on then, show us. And so, yeah, there we all were, me flying a Boeing 737. If that had been a real world situation, it would have probably been described as a crash landing, but technically it did land. And there's an expression in the world of aviation that any landing that you can walk away from is a good landing. So we all walked away from that safely. So, yeah. And the food was good as well, I think.
Let's circle back to this podcast. What does quarter life crisis mean to you?
In my life, a quarter life crisis has become a bit of a coined term, like as a almost suggests as an element of definition and uniformity. That's not the right word. It suggests that like it's a defined term that we're all going to experience one. One thing I would say to me, quarter life crisis now. It just means questioning what to do next and if you're on the right path. And maybe to add practical element to that, I think I've at least had two. So again, it doesn't happen once. And they weren't really crisis mode. They weren't that negative. The walls weren't caving in. So what it means to me, I think, is just a challenge that you perhaps put to yourself involuntarily, perhaps. And you come out the other side of it either deciding to make a change or with renewed confidence that you're on the right path.
Mm.
So my two were when I started working, and it was whether this is the right thing to do. And, you know, am I going to adapt and thrive in this environment or not? And the idea, if it was not, a bit worrying as to what then do you do? And then the second time I've had it is actually kind of when I moved to Singapore. Again, not because of anything negative about moving to Singapore, but rather it felt like such a big life event. In a very strange way, it made you then wonder what comes next, almost because moving was relatively straightforward when all is said and done. And I think everyone on this podcast has also moved as well. And so whilst it seemed like a really big change, I think sometimes when you look at it objectively, you realise, oh, it's actually a bit, you know, if you've got the job and all the uni place, it's actually quite simple. You know, it happens all the time. And when I made that realization, it made me realize, oh, probably then I'm going to end up moving again. And so all of a sudden I'm dwelling on that. And I've only just arrived in Singapore, all things considered. So I think for me, perfectly normal to have it, even when things are going well, moving to work abroad, enjoying that work, all things relatively going well for me, actually can prompt a whole other set of questions, introspective questions.
I think the crisis doesn't, to me, I related it as like what you just described very accurately, that this doubt, whether this is correct and what's next, this doubt is a crisis itself, like you would experience when you are facing big changes. So to me, career life crisis is the big changes you face when you're transitioning from a student to a work employee. That is like a natural change. But then the next one, like whether you relocate or not, it's a decision that you decided to do. Like there are people who may not face this decision. So if you are feeling that intense anxiety or introspective emotions, that just means that you're making big decisions in your life. And I think at this stage in our life, the bigger decisions we make, it just, you understand yourself more and you become more confident. And that's good. That's what
It probably won't stop, right?
Usually. It won't, but it would never be as scary as the first time, I would feel like. And to me, that also, like, I'm also making some decisions whether I want to relocate or not, or what's the next step in my life. And it's very different from the first time. And to a sense that I feel like, am I at the end of core life crisis? That I know you have to make continuously make big decisions in your life, but you know,
and then compromise with something.
Yeah, compromise, but you know what you want and what's your trade-off, and you're confident that you can carry that decision over.
And also, I have to say, not to be too melodramatic, but one of the other variables that is changing as I've gotten older is, I think, exactly that. Just by getting older, I have to say, I've started to get all the sort of, as I say, slightly melodramatic points that you see raised in the movies about go enjoy your life because you'll be dead one day, basically. Yeah. Practical example, when I look back in my life, how I was behaving as a student, and that makes it sound like I did something terrible, but I mean like between the studying, the exploring, the partying, to look back on that and think, I was so relatively carefree. Now look, maybe that's just because you're a student, you're carefree in general. But I do believe it was also influenced by me just being younger and not perhaps fully appreciating that you do grow older. And with that comes good and bad things. And as I've got, especially this year in Singapore, I don't know, I felt older. Maybe it's because moving and living abroad makes you feel more mature, makes you grow up, accelerates how you're growing up in a good way, I hope. But I do feel like the added lens here is that my appetite to risk is different, in the sense that I was always thinking, got to save for the future, got to save, prepare for the future. And then you realize, oh, I might be in that future right now. And the next thing after that is death. And again, you know,
that's
so it's
so extreme.
You know, it's extreme, but you see what I mean? It's like, you know, again, I'm going to just, maybe let me say for the last time, I'm going to reference my colleague, Mike. He talked about a guy that he had seen save for his retirement for his whole career. And he used to use the example of when he used to bring in an apple that he bought on the way from the station to the office. And he would always try and get the slightly damaged apple because the person would give him a discount on it, the greengrocer. This is a real story, apparently. He used to do that. And while saving money on one apple doesn't seem like a big deal, he said it was more of the principle of he was saving as much as he could so that he could live very comfortably in his retirement. And then he did retire, but he only lived for another year or two after retiring. I don't know what happened. There's no big cataclysmic event. I don't think there was an accident or anything. He just passed away. And actually, in the city of London, it's not that uncommon a story. People, for some reason, when they retire, don't live very long. I don't know if it's got something to do with the life, the stress levels that they had in their working life. But the moral of the story, as Mike told me, is that you can spend your whole life preparing, you know, saving for the future, and then you could just drop dead before you actually get to use it. And I know, again, that sounds all very melodramatic, and that's not quite where my head's at now, but it's more the principle that you do have to balance, keep moving forward, challenging yourself, and not always worrying about what could go wrong, because what could go wrong is actually quite limited, and you end up landing somewhere in the middle. Some things go really well, some things go wrong. So yeah, that's one of the things that crossed my mind, as I say, when I think about moving again. I don't have a plan of where to move to, but I hope I could apply that mindset that just go for it, because the worst that could happen is you will return to wherever it is you were before. So yeah, I think a quarter life crisis can be perhaps, especially as I say, when you couple it with getting older, and that will, I'm assuming this happens at different ages for different people, perhaps triggered by different things. But for me, yes. I felt like when I look back on my life in my mid to early 20s, now it's changed a lot, I have to say. And I'm willing, weirdly, to take more risk than I would have as a younger person, which is almost the wrong way around. But then I'm referring to like different ages of being 20 here. So for someone who's in their 30s or 40s, they're probably thinking, you're talking about the same thing, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we're almost top of the hour. Any advice or suggestions to our audience?
First of all, thank you for having me. In terms of advice, no, I'm not in a position to give anyone advice. I would say, again, going back onto the point, not knowing it all, just taking that experience and using experience, meaning having an open mind. And maybe, as you say, you get a bit older, quarter life crisis, maybe instigating you to try new things and take the plunge. I won't, as I say, ever position this as advice because I'm still figuring it out myself and plan to still be figuring it out perhaps for the whole of my life. So all I would say on a practical basis for some people in our office, if they've asked, should I consider working abroad? Yes. I think I'm comfortable enough to answer that question by saying I would advise that you do work abroad. Take that bigger risk. Yes, it's easy for me to say this because I moved abroad and it worked quite well. It would have been bad if it had not worked well and I'd wanted to return straight away. But I like to think that even if that had been the outcome, I would look back on it when the dust settles. And it may have taken a while for the dust to settle, but you look back on it and say, I'm still glad I tried. And quite frankly, messing up and having regrets and that in life is quite a rich, adds to the richness of your character and makes you more interesting. I feel defined as much by the things that have gone wrong. And some things have, but also I'm sitting here as someone that's very fortunate and very privileged. So on the whole, not much has gone that wrong. But, you know, emotionally and things in my life haven't always worked. And I love those memories. I love sharing them. Anita, I've shared many of them with Anita before. And they're great fun. So, yeah, I would say if you're sounding like me, if you're listening to this and thinking you're like me, you know, you work in an office, you've done the right thing, you've gone to uni, got the job, maybe turn the risk dial up just a little bit. That's what I would say. Because the Owen left to his own devices was a bit closer to the whole save for your future. And that's a future where you might just drop dead. So turn up that risk dial just a little bit, even if it feels a bit uncomfortable.
One thing I wanted to say is just that Owen have been to a lot of countries in Asia. The 1 year that he moved here, like Thailand, Vietnam, Japan, Korea,
Australia,
but not Taiwan.
Not Taiwan.
Yeah, specifically not Taiwan. Great. Even so I brought this up. Yes.
Let's end the podcast with me offending your entire audience. Exactly. Wonderful. Wonderful. Now I definitely don't feel welcome.
No, but like this podcast is mostly broadcast to Taiwanese. So now you have more people that you're connected to. So we look forward to your visit to Taiwan. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I just appreciate you being here. Thanks for coming and sharing your thoughts. Yeah. And allowing me to verbally attack you all the time.
Yeah. My pleasure.
Yeah. Please Thanks continue that.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored that anyone would really want to listen to what I have to say. So I'm very happy of that.
Yep.
So thank you, Owen, again. And then you can find us on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, SoundOn, wherever you can find the link. KKBOX2. Yes.
Yep. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.